We're checking in on native mussels here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's the first statewide survey of mussels in 40 years, and the survey says that our water cleaning clams face good news and bad news. It's a mixed bag of sorts for mussels. So big picture here, freshwater mussels are one of the most imperiled groups of animals on our planet, with nearly three-quarters of species in decline. What questions do you have about mussels that are native to Wisconsin? Have you been involved with a citizen science project related to mussels? We're at 800-642-1234. Jesse Weinzinger and Lisi Kitchell are conservation biologists with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and they coordinate the Wisconsin Mussel Monitoring Program at the DNR. Jesse, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
And Lisi, welcome to you.
And good morning to you.
Well, Jesse, let's start with you. This being the first statewide survey of native mussels in decades, why have we gone so long without a real comprehensive look at how they're doing in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so a few reasons. Mussels, I mean, they're essentially glorified rocks at the bottom of a river. They don't get much attention. They're easily overlooked by volunteers, by scientists. And like you mentioned, we haven't had a statewide survey since about the 1970s when a DNR employee and his crew, Harold Mathiak, went to 460 different sites throughout the state. So as part of our Wisconsin Wildlife Action Plan, we wanted to revisit some of these sites and kind of get an update on the status of freshwater mussels throughout the state.
Well, Lisi, these glorified rocks on the bottom of lake beds, as Jesse described them, you know, they get overlooked doing their thing underwater. Can you explain for us what a mussel is?
Okay, so people use the term mussels and clams interchangeably, and you can. Technically, there's differences, but our native mussels are those bivalves that are in the bottom of the system. They have very important role in terms of purifying the water. And then we have native clams, which are much smaller. And then, of course, we have the invasive zebra mussels. So there are all kinds out there. But our native clams have been around for a long time, and they've been used historically for a long time, too.
Okay, so, Lisi, they all have in common a hinged shell. Is that right?
Right. They all have two shells. And then they have a foot. They crawl around just like a snail crawls around. And then they filter the water, which is what's, you know, their significant role in the whole system. They're basically our ecological engineers in the bottom of the rivers and lakes.
Oh, I love that. So we really need them, Jesse, to keep our waterways clean?
Absolutely. As Lisi mentioned, they are ecological engineers. An individual mussel can filter up to 20 gallons of water in a single day, depending on the species. So if you have a dense mussel bed of tens, if not hundreds of thousands of mussels, I mean, that's a free ecosystem service for everybody.
Jesse, you've pointed out that freshwater mussels are one of the most imperiled groups of animals on the planet. What makes them so vulnerable?
Yeah, absolutely. So they are among the most sensitive animals to several pollutants in our streams and lakes throughout the state. Heavy metals from heavy industry, in the last 100 years have impacted them. Mercury, chlorides, nitrates, and ammonia. Freshwater mussels, you know, they're taking in those pollutants because they can't move very far. So they're constantly siphoning in water, and there's no escape. If those pollutants are in the water column, they're either going to be impacted, they won't be able to reproduce, or they might just die right off.
We're getting briefed on our state's mussel population with Jesse Weinzinger and Lisi Kitchell. They're conservation biologists with the Wisconsin DNR. They coordinate the state mussel monitoring program. Have you found mussels when you're out on the water? Perhaps they've been stuck to the bottom of your boat. What do you think can be done to protect endangered native mussel species? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lisi, let's look specifically at native mussels. How many species do we have here in Wisconsin?
We have 50 species in Wisconsin, 24 of which are listed as threatened, endangered, or special concern. So there are a number of them that are at-risk species, and it's a function of just, you know, water quality or poor water quality in the past.
So have we lost some species over time?
We actually haven't we have a few species that have are extirpated from Wisconsin. In other words, they're no longer in Wisconsin, but they still occur in other states or in other parts of the country. And we have at least four of those species that have become extirpated from Wisconsin. But we still have 50 species, which is an amazing diversity of our native mussels.
Is it compared to other places?
Yeah, for the upper Midwest, we are comparable to the other states in the upper Midwest. There's over 300 species for North America. But if you go to the East Coast or the West Coast, they have far fewer diversity. They have maybe 20 species all total. But the Midwest has the greatest diversity. That whole upper Mississippi River system has an amazing diversity of our native mussels.
Well, Jesse, let's get into the results of the survey here. What were some of the biggest success stories you found?
Yeah, so it's a mixed bag across the state. So some river systems, you're seeing a rebound since clean water regulations in the 1970s. For example, midsections of the Wisconsin River, we're seeing a rebound in the health of freshwater mussels because some of the paper mill industries and other contaminants have been reduced. So we're seeing good recruitment in the Wisconsin River in central Wisconsin. Lower Green Bay, we're seeing small but stable populations where zebra mussels haven't been impacting our native mussels. And there's some stretches of the Milwaukee River where we're seeing the presence of a couple rare and threatened species in the state.
Let's bring in Marcus now with a question. Marcus in Milwaukee, good morning.
Good morning. So my question is, how much of an effect are zebra mussels actually having on outcompeting native mussel species? And what, as a boater or fisherman, can we do to help reduce the impact that zebra mussels may have, or how to reduce the transfer of zebra mussels?
Lisi, can you field that?
You betcha. The zebra mussels can have a huge impact on our native mussels because what they do is they attach to the shell of our native mussels, and our native mussels don't attach to things like the zebra mussels do. So they basically attach to the shell, and then they slowly over time coat the shell with zebra mussels. And so it gets to the point where the mussels can't open, they can't feed, they can't breathe, they can't reproduce. And when I'm diving in the Mississippi River, if I get a ball of zebra mussels and I break it open, I know there'll be a native mussel or a snail in there. So they basically just encapsulate them, and then they just coat the whole bottoms of the rivers and the lakes, and that makes it so that our native mussels just can't survive. So they are significant. And the best way to do it, the best way to prevent the spread of zebra mussels is just make sure you're not taking water, you're not taking vegetation, you're cleaning your boat, so you're not transporting those zebra mussels around.
Well, they
can do a lot of harm to the system.
Pause right there with Lisi Kitchell and Jesse Weisinger. They're conservation biologists with the Wisconsin DNR. They coordinate the state mussel monitoring program. What questions do you have about mussels? Have you been part of a citizen science project that dealt with mussel populations? Join in with your questions about zebra mussels and other native and invasive species. 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're learning about the health of the freshwater mussel population in Wisconsin. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. About half of the 50 native mussel species in our state are listed as endangered, threatened, or as a species of concern. And now we have this new statewide survey of native mussels. It is the first one in decades. What do you want to know about mussels? What have you noticed about the clarity of lake water or invasive mussel species? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. The DNR's conservation biologists Lisi Kitchell and Jesse Weinzinger stay with us. They coordinate the Wisconsin Mussel Monitoring Program. Jesse, looking at this statewide survey, what are some of the biggest concerns from the data that you gathered?
Yeah, so there were several areas throughout the state where there were yellow or red flags raised. So because mussels don't move very much throughout the water column or throughout the substrate, if those pollutants are present, they won't be able to reproduce. And you can actually age an individual mussel through its growth rings, kind of like a tree. So we would age them as we collected them, and we're seeing lack of recruitment in some watersheds, such as the Pecatonica and the Rock River in southern Wisconsin. The lack of young individuals of several species in those systems raises a lot of concerns for the future health of freshwater mussels.
Lisi, going back to Marcus's question on zebra mussels, when did zebra mussels become a problem? How did they get to Wisconsin in the first place?
They came in during the 80s. They came into the Great Lakes from the big boats that go overseas from Eastern Europe. That's where they originated from. And they would come in the ballast of those boats, and then when they would change over that ballast water in the Great Lakes, that's how they got spread to our Great Lakes. From our Great Lakes, they got spread by recreational craft into our inland waters. So, and that's unfortunately the mechanism of how they're still getting spread. So we really encourage people to try to make sure that they don't spread them any further than they are. They got into the Mississippi River and some of our main rivers, again, through the barges that would go from the Illinois River then into the upper Mississippi River. And again, it's from the bilge and the ballast in those large boats.
In those water tanks, yeah. Let's go to Jerry now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
My question is this. I grew up on the East Coast in the ocean, but I used to see mussels attached to piers, you know, small piers in the bay. But what species of mussels do we eat that we see in the restaurants or grocery stores?
Jerry, yeah thank you. Well, Lisi, do you want to field that?
Sure. So the mussels that we eat are the marine mussels. We don't eat our native freshwater mussels. They certainly can be eaten, but I don't recommend they be eaten because of contaminants. But the marine mussels, they monitor them closely. They check them for healthy, you know, to make sure that they don't contain high levels of contaminants. And the mussels that you saw on the pier, those are, you know, blue ocean mussels, and those are the ones that are eaten and are harvested, and as well as the ocean clams. So those are the guys that you do eat. But our native ones, we're eaten in great numbers by Native Americans, but I don't recommend we eat them nowadays.
Jesse, zebra mussels get a lot of the attention on the invasive mussel front. Are there other invasives that we should be concerned about?
Oh, absolutely. So as we mentioned, there is the zebra mussel that can not only impact our native mussels, but industry, dams, indirectly fish. There's another mussel called the quagga mussel that's in the same family as zebra mussel, but the quagga mussel is actually displacing the zebra mussel throughout the Great Lakes. So if we start bringing them into our inland lakes and rivers, that can have potentially even a larger effect on the ecosystem. Separate from that, we have the Asian clam, which is another invasive brought over from Eurasia, and that can have detrimental effects on our fingernail clam population, but also other invertebrates. So those are kind of our invasive mussels. Otherwise, we have several other invasive species like Phragmites from plants to Eurasian water milfoil, other aquatic plants that can have huge effects not only on mussels but other aquatic resources.
Can't these clams also really cut up your feet, these invasives? They're kind of sharp shells.
Yeah, the zebra mussels in particular leave their shells behind. They don't, they're shorter lived. Our our native mussels are very long lived, but the zebra mussels are short lived. So after a few years, they die, and then they leave these small shells that are very sharp. And indeed, they can cut your feet on beaches. They can cut, like if you're out walking your dog at the beach, that they make the, they take a sandy beach or even a rocky beach, and they make it into just full of shards of sharp shells.
We're talking with Lisi Kitchell and Jesse Weinzinger. They're conservation biologists with the Wisconsin DNR. They coordinate the state's mussel monitoring program. You have a line with your questions, your observations, 800-642-1234. What do you think can be done to protect endangered native mussel species? Are you concerned about invasive species in your lake? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Lisi, I would imagine that just like too few mussels, too many mussels is also a problem. How do you control mussel populations if you need to?
Well, our native mussels are kind of in balance with our natural systems because they have a limiting factor. They need a fish host to complete their life cycle, so that kind of gives them a limiting factor. The zebra mussels are an example of one that becomes overabundant, zebra mussels and quagga mussels both. They just become super abundant, and they cover everything that they come in contact with. So how you control them is, we have not found the silver bullet for controlling those guys yet. So once they're established, they're really hard to get rid of. But our native mussels seem to be in balance with the natural systems, and they don't seem to get overly abundant.
So, Jesse, how do you want to use the new survey results to kind of shape your efforts in conservation and what you do with mussels going forward?
Absolutely. So the 99 sites that we visited across the state can serve as a baseline for future monitoring and conservation needs. So we followed standardized protocols during our surveys. So they're written up in our reporting forms. So, you know, whether it be 5 years from now, whether it be 10 years from now, we can revisit these sites doing the same protocol and compare what we found. If we're seeing a large decline, 5 years after our last survey, that may allow us to address more of our resources to identifying the cause of the problem, implementing conservation actions, such as nutrient management, if it's an agricultural area, or in-stream restoration efforts, stream bank stabilization. There are a lot of efforts we can take, but this last survey can serve as a baseline for future monitoring needs.
Well, Lisi, what can the average person do to help mussels here in Wisconsin?
There's a lot they can do in terms of just trying to improve water quality and ensure that habitat is protected. Jesse mentioned stream bank stabilization. One of the things is erosion, all the sediment that comes into the water. The other thing is runoff from urban runoff, from the various contaminants from urban runoff, and as well as some of the runoff from agricultural runoff. So what we can do to put buffers along streams to intercept all that runoff is one thing we can do. I think we've done it since the Clean Water Act. We've done a lot to improve those point sources coming in at the pipes. So that, I think, is a good thing. But the citizens can still ensure that we try to maintain and improve our water quality is probably the best way to do it.
And I understand you're looking for some citizen scientist volunteers to help with the eastern pond mussel, Lisi?
Sure. Well, that's one of them. A few years ago, a person who was a citizen scientist had contacted me and said, I have a mussel here and I can't figure out what it is. And I looked at it and said, well, that's a whole new species for the state of Wisconsin. So we went up to the Oneida Lakes. It was a three lakes chain that we went to, and found that it was in a number of those lakes. So now we're trying to figure out just how far this mussel spread. It's not an invasive species. It's just a new species for new species for Wisconsin, but it is one of the native species rather than the invasive zebra or quagga mussels. So we're trying to figure out just where it goes, what lakes it's in, and how far it has spread since it's been introduced to Wisconsin.
Well, Lisa, go ahead, Jesse.
Oh, sorry. I just wanted to add on to that. So in addition to what Lisa said, this coming month, August 18th, we're actually hosting a mussel blitz on the Eagle River chain. So Lisa mentioned we found them throughout the Three Lakes chain, and just downstream, it's connected to the Eagle River chain, which is a complex of about 13 lakes. So we're going to have a volunteer outing on August 18th, and we're going to utilize citizen scientists and other biologists to go out and see how widespread this mussel has become.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Lisa Kitchell and Jesse Weisinger are conservation biologists with the Wisconsin DNR. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. News is next here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about heritage languages on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A first language or a native language is one that a person has been exposed to since birth. And the Census Bureau says about a fifth of the U.S. population speaks a language other than English at home. Sometimes that language never leaves home, but educators are working to change that. And one example is the Hmong Language and Culture Enrichment Program here in Madison. It helps Hmong school-age kids learn their native language and culture. Did you grow up speaking a language at home and then you fine-tuned those skills in school? What has your knowledge of this language allowed you to do? Do you use it in your job today? Are you a parent who speaks to your child only in a native language? Why is that? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Kathy Stafford is an associate professor in UW-Madison's Department of Spanish and Portuguese. She directs the Senkit Language Acquisition Doctoral Program. Kathy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you.
Well, heritage languages, we've heard about them as using them in the home. Can you put some numbers on this? How many people speak heritage languages here in Wisconsin?
In Wisconsin, the percentage is slightly lower than what you mentioned in the introduction. According to the American Community Survey from a couple of years ago, about 9% of the population reported speaking a language other than English at home. And most of those are actually also saying that they speak English very well. So we're talking about bilingual individuals who are also speakers of a non-English language.
The Census Bureau says the number of people in the U.S. speaking a heritage language has steadily increased since the 70s. Do we know what accounts for that steady climb?
In Wisconsin, what I know about Spanish speakers in the state, the increase in the population is due to U.S.-born Hispanics, actually. So it's a combination of continuous immigration and, in the case of Wisconsin, U.S.-born Hispanics.
So what are some of the most common heritage languages that we do see here in Wisconsin?
The most commonly spoken heritage language is Spanish, and the second most, as you alluded to also in the introduction, is Hmong. There are also numerous speakers of German, and overall, the Department of Public Instruction says that there are more than 100 non-English languages that are spoken across the state, but those three, Spanish, Hmong, and German, count the most speakers.
What do we know about indigenous languages?
Indigenous languages, strictly speaking, are not heritage languages. Heritage languages are brought to a place by immigration. But what we know about the number of speakers, if that's what you mean, of indigenous languages, is that there are very, very few. tribes that I've spoken with have said that they have a handful or fewer elders who are native languages, native speakers, rather, of those indigenous languages. And they're trying to increase the numbers of those who speak the language as a second language. So in terms of numbers, there are very few. So these are languages that are in grave danger of disappearing.
We are learning about heritage languages with Kathy Stafford. She directs the Second Language Acquisition Doctoral Program at UW-Madison. What resources do you wish you had growing up to master a heritage language? Are you taking courses right now to help fine-tune your skills in a language you spoke only at home or within a community? Why did you decide you wanted to build your skills in this language? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Kathy, if we were to make the case for people to develop their heritage language skills outside of the home, what kind of benefits do you see from speaking more than one language proficiently?
There's a whole host of benefits that range from obvious social and emotional benefits to cognitive benefits, economic benefits, not only for the individual, but for families, communities, and indeed the state. And in terms of the cognitive benefits, which are what really interests me, there are studies that have concluded that being bilingual can increase your capacity for focusing your attention in the face of distraction, creativity, flexibility in thinking, enhanced problem-solving skills. So those are just to name a few of the cognitive benefits, and we could go on talking about social benefits.
Yeah, what are those?
Well, languages are all about building relationships. Relationships are built through and in languages. And the more languages you speak, the more people you can reach out to and share your experiences and understand and broaden worldviews. And so I can see only positive social benefits for being bilingual, multilingual.
What are you seeing on the career front in terms of job opportunities?
More and more opportunities, that is, and in more and more sectors, you could say. I was recently given the opportunity to participate in a project where I spoke to business leaders from different sectors from across the state, and everybody had a story. Everybody had a story of either securing a deal or losing a deal because of language proficiencies and cultural competencies to be able to relate to potential and existing business partners in their own language is incredibly powerful in an economic sense. And yeah, as I mentioned before, just building relationships.
Well, let's bring in a call now. David is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, David.
Hey, how's it going, ladies?
Good, David. So what would you like to bring forth here about heritage languages?
Well, my grandparents came from Sicily, and although they were concerned with this kind of outmoded concept of assimilation, some of the language and the dialect, the Sicilian dialect, which wasn't Italian, it was a subset of Italian with a lot of Arabic influence, survived nonetheless. So they tried to get everyone to speak English because they were concerned with the accent and they wanted proficient English speakers within a generation. But we kept so many words, and it has come in so handy for us, especially when we decide, for instance, we don't want to be understood in public, where we see regular white people doing something and we want to curse them for their boorish mouth agape, red-faced ineptitude.
Well, David, let me ask you this. Have you seen this language passed down to a younger generation? What about the kids today?
No, it's dead. Italians in Italy, they say internet. They say television. These languages are dead. Language is a living, fluid thing. It either absorbs other languages or it atrophies and dies.
Well, David, thanks so much. And Kathy, what would you say there to David?
Well, as you said, David, languages are living things, and you could say that they're dead because they are different from what they were generations ago, but languages do nothing but change. And so you could argue both ways, that the languages are dead or that they have evolved, as all languages do.
And what do you feel about this sort of assimilation that he brings up, that it's okay to know different languages and speak them in the U.S.?
Sure. Well, assimilation in terms of being an American or becoming an American is one issue, and then assimilating languages is another. And I can't recall exactly what David was saying in terms of his own family's assimilation, but every family has a story of adapting and adjusting to a new place that they've adopted as their home. And assimilation is a very natural part of that process.
Let's bring in Cordelia in Oshkosh. Hi, Cordelia.
Yes. I'm Cordelia. Yes. Hi, good morning. Thank you for hosting this talk. It's very, very interesting to me. I am a Swiss American. My mother came over here in the 1960s and raised us speaking English because she thought it would be confusing to us, even though she herself had grown up multilingual coming from Switzerland. And also, I think there was also the stigma, you know, she was an immigrant. She wanted to fit in. She didn't want us to stand out. And but we did have the opportunity as children to go visit our grandparents in Switzerland a few times. Of course, they all spoke English. But it sparked in me as a young person an interest in languages and a real desire to learn German. And I went on to learn German very well, study it. I even have a master's in German and then master's in second language acquisition as well. And I became, you know, adamant that when I had kids, I was going to raise them bilingually. So it kind of skipped a generation. So my kids, you know, by the time they get to college, you know, their German is going to be good enough that they can, you know, skip out of all of those intro classes, you know, if they want to. So anyway, the reason I did it was because, you know, number one, I knew how hard it was to learn it as an adult or a young adult. And also I knew from my studies that it was good for their brains. And the neat thing is I have experienced only positive feedback in my community to what I'm doing. I mean, I know when I was a kid, my mom was kind of, what language your mom speak? Swedish? What is that? Why would, you know? And now it's kind of like, wow, cool. You're raising your kids bilingually. I wish, you know, our kids could, you know, do this. And there's this really encouraging, welcoming feeling about it. And it's interesting. And I'm seeing that we have a lot of refugees coming to Fox Valley, and I've worked a lot with World Relief. And I've seen this, like, this tendency of these generations that are coming to, you know, of course, want to assimilate. Their kids don't want to stand out. They try to, you know, learn English. But I also work at the university, and I work with a lot of Hmong students who are now second, third generation. And there's a real strong desire for them to, like, learn the language and speak the language to their children. And so that's interesting to me because, you know, there is that when you come, there's that stigma that you're from a different country, you need to fit in. But then the next generation says, hey, let's try to revive that. Let's be proud of that.
Well, Cordelia, thank you so much for bringing this. We are learning about heritage languages and our country's current language capacity in our education system. Kathy Stafford is an associate professor in UW-Madison's Department of Spanish and Portuguese. Do you teach at a school with a dual language program? What do you want people to know about it? 800-642-1234. Stay with us. Maybe we'll hear your story on a heritage language on the Ideas Network. We're talking about heritage languages, those native languages often that don't get developed outside the home. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the Census Bureau, more than 60 million Americans speak a language other than English at home, and that number has been steadily growing since the 70s. But very few people develop proficiency in a language other than English in school. So what does that mean for the state of language here in the U.S.? Your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Are you a parent who decided not to speak your native language with your child at home, instead focusing on English mastery? How do you feel about that decision? Was it a conscious one? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Kathy Stafford stays with us. She directs the Second Language Acquisition Doctoral Program at UW-Madison. Kathy, we were talking there with Cordelia. She was telling us about raising her kids, speaking German. Are we seeing people now who regret not being able to be totally proficient in their heritage language and then reversing course for their own kids, really honing in on it?
The majority of students that I've spoken to in my work at the university are undergraduate students. They almost all have some feeling of regret if it was not a language that was supported in the home and certainly in the schools. And so that feeling of regret that I think both David and Cordelia were alluding to is something that is very common. And so it's in the case of Cordelia's family where the language acquisition skipped a generation, we find families that are taking it back up again and either studying it formally in schools or deciding as a family that they're going to either set aside some time during the day or have this sort of language island in the home. And whether or not that's increasing recently, I could not say. I don't know.
Well, when we look at the school setting, how do dual language programs work?
There are a couple of different models. There is the one-way dual language and two-way dual language immersion. And in the one-way, the program has students who are all either home language speakers of a non-English language or all native English speakers. And in two-way dual language immersion, we have a 50-50, or that's the goal anyway, to have half of the students speaking the non-English language as the home language and the other half speaking English in the home. And from the earlier grades, it tends to be more of the partner language, the non-English language, that is used as the language of instruction. And then as the students go through the years, if it's a multi-year program, then it gets up to a 50% of the day where they're using English and 50% of the day where they're using the partner language.
What do we see with outcomes there? And are dual language immersion programs spreading in our country?
They do seem to be spreading, yes. In Wisconsin, the spread has been slow, but there are some programs in some urban areas and districts, mostly in Spanish, but there are a handful that are in languages other than Spanish, as the partner language, I mean. And across the country, we could point to some very successful outcomes. Particularly one case is the state of Utah, where they have developed programs in about 140 schools where there are dual language immersion classes from kindergarten through high school. Here in Wisconsin, so far, it's through elementary primarily, starting in kindergarten and then going through grade 5 or 6. There are efforts to add years so that the students have that access to bilingual development through their middle and high school years.
You recently co-directed the Wisconsin Language Roadmap Initiative, which looks to boost the state's economic competitiveness by promoting languages. What did you see through that roadmap? What did you learn through it?
So many things. As I mentioned earlier, participation in that project afforded me the opportunity to be speaking with business leaders who all said that there is demand for multilingual employees at all levels in a number of different sectors. And we also learned by talking with educators across the state that our capacities, there's a lot of hunger to learn different languages other than English, in addition to English, I should say. And capacity really varies in terms of the languages that can be offered. There is a dire teacher shortage for English, for non-English languages across the country. And so there is demand, there is capacity, but that capacity can certainly be improved by promoting people going into the teaching profession.
There are not a lot of opportunities for kids to learn Hmong in school or even in programs, but are there efforts to change that?
Hmong specifically, I'm not very knowledgeable about. What I do know about languages that do not have classes or formal offerings in schools, a lot of communities have grassroots efforts to offer culture classes, to offer language classes on weekends, summer programs. And so a lot of the efforts are grassroots and community-centered.
At UW-Eau Claire, there was this effort to preserve the Walloon language, which is a dying language found in eastern Wisconsin spoken by Belgian immigrants. Why do efforts like these matter when it comes to promoting linguistic diversity here in the state?
Well, everything is tied to language, and this is speaking as a linguist, so I fully admit my biases.
It all comes back to you, right, Kathy? It's all about you.
But culture is wrapped up in language. The entire history of a nation, of a place, is wrapped up in language, and so to lose that is devastating. And not only do we lose linguistic diversity, but we lose cultural diversity as well, and that is nothing but tragic, as far as I'm concerned.
Let's go to Karen in Freedom now. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I have a chance to go to Greece and meet some distant relatives in the spring, so I've been trying to learn Greek. I found some apps and some online resources that teach you words and phrases, and I've ordered a book online for grammar, because I want to become conversational. Do you know of any other resources that I can tap into?
Great question, Karen. Thank you.
Well, Karen, it sounds like you've tapped into the resources that are most available. A lot of people have the impression that you have to learn a language and then speak it. Another wonderful resource is learning through speaking. So your experience when you go to Greece will probably be the best language learning resource out there.
It's also directed towards some Greek churches that maybe the elders still speak it.
Oh, that's a neat idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Finding communities within your own community, some pockets of where you might find native speakers.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Karen, thanks so much for the call. Have a wonderful trip. Kathy, what resources are available to people interested in a second language or even in helping kids master a second language?
Well, the resources that Karen mentioned, and also there are... as I alluded to before, there are community efforts where speakers of the language have things as simple and community-based as having a coffee hour every week. They get together. I was lucky enough to go up to Ulu, Wisconsin a couple of years ago, and there are Heritage Finnish speakers up there, and they took it upon themselves to self-organize, and they come together and they have coffee and they practice speaking their Finnish. And so those, finding those pockets that you were alluding to, I think that's about the best thing that you can hope for. Create your own sort of immersion experience, and learn through speaking.
Kathy, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Kathy Stafford is an associate professor at UW-Madison's Department of Spanish and Portuguese and director of the Second Language Acquisition Doctoral Program at the university. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.